everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Hey, thank you for joining me today. It's Giving Tuesday. And for me, every Tuesday is Giving Tuesday when I'm doing my show, It's All About Food, giving you the truth and tools that you need, or that I like to think you might be interested in when it comes to food. I'm really looking forward to today's program. Let's bring on my first guest. Lana D. Povitz is visiting assistant professor of history at Middleborough College. And Lana has written a book, Stirrings, How Activist New Yorkers Ignited a Movement for Food Justice. Let's get right to it. Lana, how are you today?
Hi, I'm well, Karen.
Good. You're in Middlebury College in Vermont. That's where it is, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sitting here in my office.
And it's I'm imagining it's a charming little cottage, a college town.
Yeah, it's very beautiful.
Yeah.
Very collegey. Yeah.
I haven't been to Vermont in a while, but I've always enjoyed going there because it's just stunning for the most part.
Yeah. So, it's very beautiful. It very contrasts very much with New York City, but also beautiful.
Yeah, I walked all along Central Park earlier today, and I love it. It's just amazing what they've done with it. So, what I wanted to start with is talking about the history of history. And what I mean by that is I loved when I was in school, in elementary school, junior high school, college, whatever. I love most of my subjects. I never cared for social studies or history. And it wasn't until I was an adult and started reading different kinds of history than I was introduced to when I was in school. Because back when I was in school, and this was a long time ago, history was about war. History was about the leaders who had those wars, the victors. And it wasn't until I discovered like Howard Zinn's The People's History of the United States that there were lots of other stories that we didn't talk about. And I find those other stories a lot more interesting and compelling. And so do you know when the history of history changed like that, when the stories changed?
Well, you know, there's a lag between what gets published and what gets taught in schools, right? So even when when I was in high school, when I was in college, I didn't have access to the kinds of classes that, for example, my students at Middlebury now get to take, all about, you know, food politics or social movement history. We didn't have any of that. So I think that there was sort of a sea change in the kinds of histories that got written, really starting in the 60s and 70s with all of the social movements, the women's liberation movement, civil rights and black power, the creation of ethnic studies and women's studies departments. And I think that produced a lot of great new stuff, but I don't think it filtered down. I think it took a lot of years, maybe 50 years.
Yeah.
And also to change, you know, publishing also, it can be very conservative. So I sympathize with that sense that history is kind of a lot of wars, a lot of white men, sometimes other great men. You know, we learned, certainly a lot of my colleagues learned about Martin Luther King, you know, but definitely didn't learn about Ella Baker. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. And I have enjoyed reading the real history once it became available.
Yeah.
Including your book.
Thanks.
Yeah. So I liked a lot of things about your book. One of the things I liked is I'm a New Yorker. I grew up in New York. I mean, I've lived in California. I've lived in the south of France. I've been around. But now I'm back in New York. And I'm an activist. And I'm a food activist. And there's a lot of things in this book that I didn't know that I really enjoyed reading about. So the first question is, you focus on four different organizations, United Bronx Parents, the Park Slope Food Co-op, God's Love We Deliver, and Community Food Resource Center. How did you pick those four? Were there others to choose from? I don't know.
Oh, it's a great question. Well, it was very serendipitous. You know, in retrospect, it looks very obvious because these are four, among the foremost, I would say, successful and effective nonprofit food organizations that the city produced between the 1960s and the early 2000s. But initially, it kind of came together piecemeal. I had done in grad school a project on Park Slope Food Co-op. I had been reading the work of Jan Popendick, who's an amazing sociologist and historian, and she said you should talk to Kathy Goldman, who had been involved with both United Bronx Parents and the Community Food Resource Center. She actually founded it. So I started to investigate those two organizations more, and then I wanted something with a very different kind of politics, and I forget who I was talking to, but somebody said, what about God's Love We Deliver? So I thought, oh yeah, let me check them out. And it kind of just came together that way, but I think that when you read the book, they all do stand out as kind of very differently effective, but effective nonprofits. I actually didn't think I was going to write about nonprofits at all. I had hoped to, you know, this is a grassroots history, and I didn't initially think that grassroots meant nonprofits. But that was one of the big surprises for me, is just understanding how much of leftist energies, progressive energies, got channeled into nonprofit service provision.
Yeah.
But I had thought, you know, I used to work with a group called Food Not Bombs.
Oh, yes.
Food Not Bombs, which is, you know, nationally sort of represented in other places in the world. And I had been interested in kinds of disorganized, intentionally anti-authoritarian kinds of grassroots politics. And I only ended up writing about nonprofits in the end because I wanted to write about groups that really changed something on a large scale. It turns out that nonprofits are often an effective way to do that.
I'm remembering Food Not Bombs. I believe one of their challenges was that in some places you couldn't give food away.
Yeah, in Florida they were criminalizing people for that.
Yeah, crazy stuff, this planet.
Wild.
and the human species that lives on it. I want to talk.
Michael Bloomberg, when he was mayor, would make it illegal for people to donate food to homeless shelters because it didn't necessarily have the right fat, sugar, and salt content.
Oh, goodness.
Regulate it.
Right. Okay, well, keep that in mind when you're considering voting for Democratic potential presidential nominations.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to talk about each of these groups that you highlighted, but before we do, I mentioned it's Giving Tuesday today, and everybody is inundated and overwhelmed with all of the emails and Facebook posts and wherever, where all of the organizations are asking for money. I have a nonprofit, Responsible Eating and Living. You can find it at responsibleeatingandliving.com, and we put out our notice about Giving Tuesday because, you know, everybody's doing it. The thing is, though, you touched on this in the book, and that is the economy has changed and the government has changed over the last 50 years or so, probably starting with Reagan's time frame, where the government was more giving to people in need, and those benefits are like slowly whittling away. So nonprofits really depend on donations from the public, and there are problems with that. Especially where we look for big donations from people who have a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally feel that we're giving them a lot more power and that they can make more decisions about what's going on in the world because they have the money, not just for themselves, but to donate to the organizations that need it. And it wasn't always that way. Was it?
Mm-hmm. No.
Yeah. So
I mean, the government, you know, there, when Ronald Reagan and others chose to reduce taxes for Americans, they were giving up a big source of money that they could use to help poor people. And that was intentional because it changed the game so that government spending on programs for low-income people and other disadvantaged people, that kind of looked like, that came to look like bad, irresponsible politics. But it was a choice to change the structure of taxation. And I think that's really what's given all this space for private philanthropy to take up so much room.
Exactly. Now, let's start with United Bronx Parents. Can you just give us we don't have a lot of time. I want people to read the book. But can you just give me a brief overview of what they did, who they
were? Sure. So this organization was founded in the 1960s really to work on the inequality of New York City schools. That was its initial goal because the racism of the Board of Education, as it was then called, was so egregious. So it was mostly Puerto Rican mothers, but also some African American mothers who rallied to empower parents to fight for change in their kids' school. And they ended up leading the first sustained grassroots movement to improve school lunch. So they were on this in the late 1960s. I should mention that the organization was founded by Evelina Antonetti, who's an amazing, charismatic community leader who was involved with the organization through the 80s until her death. So they worked on all kinds of issues, drug treatment for women with children, representation of Puerto Ricans in popular, they did all kinds of things, not just food, but they were really in the lead not only with school lunches, but also with setting up free summer meals. So in 1971, and I write about this, the city refused to take on this program, which had become a federal entitlement, which meant that all cities could have free summer meals for children. But it was sort of the city was overwhelmed. So the United Bronx Parents ended up taking it on, and they administered the program, feeding hundreds of thousands of children each day. So they're quite cutting edge.
I'm not sure where school lunch programs are around the country today, but some of what you wrote about was the changes that were made, and some of the changes were to support feeding children industrial processed foods that you could easily heat up. So equipment was purchased to just do the heating up rather than installing real kitchens where you could make real food.
Yes, and the Puerto Rican mothers, to their credit, absolutely hated that microwave system. A lot of these mothers, even though they were poor, were wonderful cooks, and they really knew what their children would eat and what would make for good food. And they also knew that people in the South Bronx in the late 60s and early 70s needed jobs. So what they had proposed, which was very innovative, was that schools that had kitchens should be allowed to cook for all of the schools in the area that didn't have kitchens, on-site, fresh, hot food. And then the Board of Education completely ignored their suggestions, all of which were really replicable, really doable. They did a model lunch to prove that they could do it for even less money than the board was spending on lunches. And they just wouldn't, the board just wouldn't hear it. And they just installed these, what were called convenience kitchens, to serve students this horrible processed food that was bad for them, and most of which got thrown out, as it still can. So they weren't successful in that sense. But they did have an awareness of what it could look like to do school lunch well.
And I'm sure it's very different all over the United States, where you have some places that today make nutritious meals and other places that just don't.
Yeah. But New York City is quite special because it recently, I mean, there's a few other cities that do this too, but as I'm sure you know, they recently implemented universal school meals, which is something that, you know, food advocates have been fighting for 50 years or more. Will your listeners know what I mean by universal school
meals? No, tell us.
So this is a really important thing. So when there are public feeding programs, and that could be school lunches, that could be school breakfast, that could be food stamps, EBT, WIC, the Women and Infants and Children Feeding Program, all of these programs are entitlements. American citizens, or sometimes even non-citizens, should be able to access them. But when these programs are means tested, which means when people have to submit paperwork to talk about what kinds of money their family makes, that really stigmatizes the programs, and it gets them to be seen as poor people's programs or poor kids' programs. And then children especially will stay away from those programs. So in a school where kids who are receiving the free meals have to wait in a different line than the ones who are paying full price, it brings down the status of the program, and it makes people not want to use it. So Universal School Meals deals with this by doing away with means testing. It means they're available to everybody, whoever wants one, whether they technically need it or sort of need it or don't need it but just want it. Everybody's all getting the same thing. And what that does is that it increases the quality over time, because middle-class kids come to use those programs too. And the stigma sort of is gone when that happens. So it's quite important. And there actually was a study recently published by the university, the Syracuse University, I believe, called, I think it was like Let Them Eat Lunch, which just says, which was something everybody knows intuitively, teachers certainly know, that students who eat breakfast and eat lunch do better in school than the ones who are hungry and can't learn as well. But they proved somehow that they gain up to 10 weeks of learning by everybody eating lunch. So, you know, I don't know about quantifying things in this way, but it's a really important issue and it pays huge dividends. So if we lived in a country that was really serious about educating people, food provision would be a no-brainer.
That's right. I would think, too, I know there are some people who don't want to pay taxes so that other people get benefits. And something like this would be more minimal to them because it's for everyone.
Right.
I would hope. Yes.
I mean, hopefully, but if we really want to look at what the government spends its money on, we know it's not welfare programs.
Yeah.
You know, we know it's the military. It's a huge difference. These amounts of money to feed people are so small. They're so inconsequential. It's really a lot. It's quite symbolic, I think, more than about crunching actual numbers.
Okay, so then there's the Park Slope Food Co-op, and I've been there, and mm-hmm. I love it. And it was really fun reading about the history. We don't have a lot of time, so I just want to say, if anyone is interested in food co-ops, this is a great source to read about the Park Slope Food Co-op, because it's the best in the country, right?
Yeah, the New Yorker just did a great piece on it.
Oh, I have to read that.
And yeah, it's good.
Do you know what issue it was? Because I've got a stack of New Yorkers at home waiting for me.
Oh, I think it was 2 issues ago.
Okay, good. I'll look for it. And if people want to start a co-op, which I think is a great idea, you can learn a lot from the Park Slope Food Co-op in terms of what works and what doesn't work and things to look out for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I just loved, I love the history. The one point that you made about how it was primarily started by a bunch of, can I just say privileged white people? I don't know how else to.
Sure.
I don't know how
they
else to
agree.
Say it. There are advantages and disadvantages to that. Certainly, they all were like in sync, so they could agree on things a lot more easily, I suppose.
Yeah, no, definitely. I definitely make that argument.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just something that happened, and it worked.
And it has worked. They've
yeah.
done, I mean, the thing is, it's not incompatible to say that people were white and privileged and worked really hard and had great ideas and made a thing happen. You know what I mean? Sometimes both of those things go together.
Mm-hmm.
The issue was more about not having structures in place to deal with not only challenges to capitalism, because as a co-op, they're kind of already doing that, but what to do about the force of white supremacy in the world. You know, what to do about, to a lesser extent, gender issues, although to be fair, most people, everyone I spoke to sees it as a pretty egalitarian space gender-wise. But the race thing is difficult. I mean, that's what happens when all white people start something. It has often has a lot of racism.
But they've worked through that over the years.
They're working on it. I mean, I don't think that's something any organization that has a lot of white people ever fully works through, but I think there's been a lot of efforts to deal with instances of bias and discrimination. I think that definitely in hiring and staff policies, it's certainly a very diverse place racially. I don't really know. I mean, the thing, as a historian, I don't really have to contend with what's happened, you know, what's happening right now. I do know there's a conversation about whether the staff, some staff want to unionize or not, and that's been interesting, but I'm not quite sure what's happening with that.
Okay, let's move to God's Love We Deliver. And this one was heart-wrenching. And I loved reading about it, to know that there are good people on the planet. It just inspires me, the whole concept. I love that. So, okay, I won't tell you what I love yet. You tell us about what this organization is first, God's Love We Deliver.
So God's Love We Deliver was founded at the early on during the AIDS crisis, 1985, by two women who had been devotees of an Indian guru who told them to tend to the dying. So they were actually not part of the AIDS communities. They didn't really have a connection to it, but they saw the suffering of people with AIDS and thought especially how people were kind of being abandoned by their families, sometimes certainly by the city government, the federal government. And there wasn't much being done. So they decided that they were going to bring really good food to people who were too sick to leave their homes, people who were dying. And if you had an AIDS diagnosis before the mid-90s, it may as well have been a death sentence mm-hmm. for many, many, many people. So they innovated this system, initially getting donations from restaurants to bring to people, and then eventually they got their own kitchen and started bringing in all these volunteers to cook meals and to deliver them to people's homes. And then they expanded to also feed people who had other kinds of illnesses that were keeping them homebound. So there's all kinds of people who can qualify for that today. It's an ongoing organization. It's a wonderful organization. You can call and get a free meal delivered tomorrow that's tailored to your health needs. There's no wait list. And, you know, it's helped a lot of people in a very practical, meaningful way. But what I talk about is not only the people who it helped, who were receiving the meals, but the people who had a way of being of service through whether it was chopping carrots and potatoes or driving a truck or soliciting donations. I mean, whatever people kind of wanted to do, there was a space for them to do it. And that's what was really amazing about the organization, is that it gave so many people a way in to this crisis that otherwise was, you know, filling people with despair. People were losing all of their friends every week. There was no cure. There was nothing to do a lot of the time except to organize or to provide. So there's a lot of conversation that goes to ACT UP, which is the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, which is a kind of direct action group. And then there's a kind of service providing work that people like God's, or organizations like God's Love We Deliver gave to people.
Well, one of the things that I loved about this section, but the whole book, are all the little stories that involved individuals and their successes and their challenges. But I just wanted to mention now, what I loved was when you said they were getting started and they were using restaurants, and they would just call up a high-end restaurant and say, I want to make an arrangement where I call you, I order a meal that my client wants. We have somebody pick it up. We don't pay you. And that's it. And they agreed.
Yep. A lot of restaurateurs agreed. And this is kind of the thing that the founders found, which is that people are actually very eager to help. If you give people work that they can actually do, and you have a request that makes sense and that people are capable of doing, people are very eager to be generous. And a lot of the time inaction happens because people don't know, there's no channel for their goodwill to flow through. And, you know, a lot of those restaurateurs knew, you know, they were a part of communities that were being hit. So they understood what was happening. And I think they were actually quite grateful that they had an opportunity to do this, to be of service in that way.
Okay, we have a few minutes left, and I wanted to touch on the Community Food Resource Center. Can you tell us a little bit about that group?
So that's a wonderful organization. It no longer directly exists, but the kind of current version of it is an organization called Community Food Advocates, which is still doing amazing work. But Community Food Resource Center was founded by Kathy Goldman in 1980, right as Reagan was getting elected. And originally what they wanted to do was expand federal food programs to make them sort of proliferate throughout New York and to bring in good food jobs. I mean, now we have the language of good food jobs, meaning jobs that are in the food service sector that are well paid. And the initial vision was very much to expand that. As Reagan started to undo the social fabric of the country, they got into a mode of just trying to stop things from getting worse. And so they ended up doing, on one hand, they were advocating still for these food programs, trying to stop cuts to food stamps, trying to stop cuts to welfare, but they were also increasingly providing direct services. So they were the group, one of the groups behind founding the New York City Food Bank. They founded a model soup kitchen, a community kitchen in Harlem that not only fed people, but also hooked them up with other kinds of services they might have needed. So legal assistance, housing assistance, that kind of thing. So they were a very interesting organization because they were both providing direct services and doing advocacy. And that combination was really important. It really meant that the advocacy was based on a direct knowledge of what people were going through. And instead of just doing the service part, they were also trying to change the circumstances to make it so that the food bank would go out of business, which obviously they were not successful in doing because of the way late capitalism has structured things. I mean, it turned out to be much easier to build model service programs than to create a socialist society, which was sort of what they would have preferred.
So you said in the beginning of the program you weren't planning on writing about nonprofits. And one of the reasons of the demise of the Community Food Resource Center was because they were a nonprofit, and the founder, who had had a vision and a way to run it, when she decided to step down and replace the executive director position with someone else, things changed dramatically. And this can happen a lot with a nonprofit when the board votes in someone new and things change, even though she was the one who had selected this person. I just want to say, can you talk a little bit about that with nonprofits, since you've learned a lot about them?
Well, what I can say, and I hope this is to your question, is that who the leadership is matters a lot. Nonprofit spaces are very social, and to a large extent, the work depends on how people are able to work together, to learn from each other, to share a vision, to inspire each other. And so, I mean, I saw that across my studies, that people continued to stay in this work, which was quite depressing and full of defeats oftentimes, more often than not. So to have strong leadership mattered greatly. I mean, in the case of Community Food Resource Center, the person that they chose to manage it, that Kathy Goldman chose to manage it after her, he sort of ran it into the ground, but a lot of those programs continued to exist under the auspices of the Food Bank for New York City. So in other words, when ideas are good, when programs are working well, they find a way to continue. It's not like that work ended. The Earned Income Tax Credit and Tax Preparation Assistance was a CFRC program, Community Food Resource Center program, and now the Food Bank carries it out. So that's just one example of many that I could name to show that the kind of long-term history of these places sometimes unravels in unexpected ways, unspools in unexpected ways.
All right. Well, I want to say again that I really enjoyed reading your book, Stirrings, How Activist New Yorkers Ignited a Movement for Food Justice. It's really fine. I mean, history, like I opened, history can be boring or it can be good. And it's especially good when it contains good stories about individuals. And this book certainly does, and it was inspiring and also frustrating because we have so much more work to do when it comes to food.
Yeah, struggle continues. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, thank you for writing Stirrings, and thank you for joining me today on It's All About Food.
Take care.
Take care. Okay, everybody, that was Lana D. Povetz. Stirrings, How Activist New Yorkers Ignited a Movement for Food Justice. All right. let's move to the second part of the show. And I am very happy to introduce my next guest, who happens to be with me in the studio. We're very lucky to have her here, Bettina Elias Siegel. And because she's from Texas, she just happens to be in New York right now, and I took advantage of that. So we are going to be talking about her new book, Kid Food, The Challenge of Feeding Children in a Highly Processed World. And it's a cute little book that has some pictures of like Fruit Loops or something on the cover, right? We all love them, don't we? Thank you for joining me and coming in today, Bettina.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. All right. So first thing I wanted to ask is kind of like why you wrote this book. Now, I know other moms who became food activists that weren't planning on it, but their stories were because their children were sick, like Robin O'Brien, I was recently talking to Zen Honeycutt, who wrote Unstoppable. There are a bunch of moms out there. Fortunately, you didn't have a problem with your children's health.
Right.
Right. That's a good thing.
Yes, a good thing.
because there are a lot of parents out there with kids that are struggling, and it's related to what they're eating, unfortunately. So why did you get into food activism?
Right. So for me, it was a very different path. As I talk about in the book, I'm trained as a lawyer, and actually a chunk of my food, my legal career, which was here in New York City, was actually working for a big food conglomerate. So it's kind of interesting that I'm now on the other side of some of these issues. But for me, the window really was school food. I had retired from the practice of law. I was pursuing a career in magazine writing, freelance writing. Had no intention of ever becoming a quote-unquote activist. That was as far from my imaginings as you can imagine. And in 2010, I was asked if I would join a committee in Houston Independent School District, where my kids were attending public school, if I wanted to join a committee that was seeking parents' input on our school food menus. And I almost didn't want to go because we weren't participating in the school meal program, precisely because the food really looked pretty subpar to me when I'd been in the cafeteria. And keep in mind, this was before the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act was implemented. So it was particularly bad. And a friend, you know, persuaded me. She said, well, if the food were better, wouldn't you be happy to not pack lunches? And I thought, well, that's true. So I went to the first meeting. And just in that one meeting, there were so many revelations that just kind of blew my mind. The first one, and as I say in the book, I'm really ashamed I didn't know this before I went to the meeting, was that in my district, and this is true of many, many urban districts, including New York City, the vast majority of public school parents are economically reliant on the school meal. So that suddenly put the whole question in a very different light for me. You know, I had the ability, fortunately, to pack my kids a lunch, but so many families did not. So what we're serving those kids really, really mattered. I learned for the first time how little money school districts have, which would really explain the meals I was seeing. You know, it was about a dollar and change per child per lunch for food after overhead is paid. And that was shocking. And then the last sort of shocking event in that one first meeting, which I relay in the book, was this just little anecdote, but it was very pivotal for me. At that time in our district, students had to take a pack of animal crackers for breakfast with their otherwise incredibly highly processed sugary breakfast. And when I asked why, the answer was, well, we need to give them the animal crackers because they provide iron. You're laughing, right?
Yeah, I read that. It was funny. Yeah.
Right. And so I'm scratching my head like, well, I can think of lots of iron-rich foods, but animal crackers wouldn't be the first one that comes to mind.
And pumpkin seeds,
right? You know, spinach, you know, dried plums, you know. And so the response was, well, you know, there's iron in the fortified white flour, and that was such a bizarre way of thinking about food for me. You know, this is what Michael Pollan would call a very nutritionism sort of view of food. And that really led me to want to learn more about the lunch program. And because I was a writer at that time, it just felt very natural to start this blog, The Lunch Tray, in 2010. I should be clear, it's not just about school food. Indeed, it's about anything related to children and food, including all of the many challenges that I felt I was facing back then when my kids were little, and it felt like there were so many forces pushing them toward unhealthy food. But really, it was that blog that became the stepping stone for me to this ultimate path, unexpected path.
Normally, when I introduce a guest on the show, I read the bio, and I didn't do that. So I want everybody to know this person is very smart.
Stop.
Bettina is a graduate of Yale College and Harvard Law School, just to name a few. and you could learn more about her. The website you have is A Lunch Tray. What's the URL?
My blog is thelunchtray.com, but people can also go to bettinasiegel.com to learn more specifically about Kid Food, the book.
Excellent. Okay. So you started this blog, and you were learning a lot as you were blogging.
Yes.
Isn't that an interesting thing?
Absolutely.
You learn a lot when you learn about the school lunch program. And you learn about capitalism. And I don't know how you feel about the United States. and, you know, there are some people that feel this is a very great country. But we could do a lot better. And, you know, some people feel like they can feed their own kids and they don't care about other kids. But the quality of education will improve when all the students are on an even keel where they're all nourished and they're all able to participate.
Absolutely, absolutely. And here in New York City, where you now have universally free meals for all children, a study just came out that middle school test scores went up.
Wow.
Since that was instituted, it makes perfect sense, right? If you're hungry, you can't concentrate. If you're hungry, you can't sit still. If you're hungry, you might be a discipline problem. I mean, it's just so fundamental that we need to nourish our children well if we want good educational outcomes, good health outcomes, you know, all of it, of course.
So I know you have some recommendations, and we'll get to some of them in a bit, but this is a very complicated problem because we have an economic system that is set up to subsidize certain foods. Most of them are not healthy foods. I'm a vegan, and I believe we should all be eating primarily plant foods. And our system supports animal food, and not necessarily the best kinds of animal food, because the animals are raised in horrific conditions, and they're not too healthy themselves. And they accumulate a lot of toxins in their own bodies because they're fed garbage that's grown with pesticides and herbicides, and it's a very complicated problem. But sometimes the way we make improvement is we can't solve the whole picture. We have to work in chunks on little things, and so school food is an issue. But it's still hard to really solve it because there are so many other issues at play.
Right. I mean, there's no question that school food is very much, you know, interconnected with agribusiness. I mean, the very foundation of the National School Lunch Program, in part, was to find an outlet for surplus agricultural commodities. So it really has its roots in the agricultural system in this country. It's actually run by the Department of Agriculture. You know, if we really wanted to start fresh, we would probably put it with the Department of Education, right, where it belongs. So, or maybe even, like, if we could have such a thing, a Department of Health, you know, wouldn't that be lovely? So, right, it really is very intimately tied to agribusiness. As you say, like school food in many ways is a microcosm of how we think about children generally in the society. How much are we willing to invest in their health when they're not our own children? How much are we willing to let corporations guide our decision-making? You know, I talk in the book, I mean, obviously, I want to make clear, school food is greatly improved by the Obama-era reforms. I don't mean to sound like I'm bashing those reforms or minimizing them. But nonetheless, even with those tremendous advances in nutrition, I talk in the book about various points at which corporate America intervened and put their hands all over those regulations and really changed science-based nutrition standards to meet, you know, corporate ends. And that doesn't surprise anyone, I'm sure, but it's certainly not ideal, obviously.
Well, most of our regulations are influenced by lobbyists.
Right.
And they affect our politicians tremendously. And I've been reading about food activism for decades. And one of my favorite books is T. Colin Campbell's A China Study. And he talks about all these panels he sat on with the government and all the science he tried to offer. And he made very little headway.
Right.
Because of big food conglomerates that want us to eat sugar and processed foods and processed oils and animals.
Right.
Okay. So what's a parent to do?
Well, I guess it depends on what exactly we're talking about. You know, are we talking about in their homes, outside their homes, in schools? You know, there are lots of things parents can do.
I mean, you brought up that children are bombarded everywhere they go. So a parent that's trying to be vigilant is really complicated because not only is there school food, but you've got sports activities where there's all kinds of crap served, and even going to a doctor's office, they're giving treats, and everywhere you go, the sugar is everywhere.
Exactly. I have this chapter called Just One Treat where I take a hypothetical fourth grader through her day and just show, I show parents, but parents don't need this information. It's people who aren't parents who probably will be surprised. You know, all the opportunities in her typical day where adults may be offering her highly processed food, usually sugary food, for all kinds of reasons. And they're not always bad reasons. Sometimes it's loving indulgence. Sometimes it's to relieve boredom. Sometimes it's to make an activity more exciting. Sometimes it's to raise money for schools that are facing budget shortfalls. Sometimes it's to keep order in the classroom. You know, it's a million different reasons, but the problem is our kids are on the receiving end of a tremendous glut of sugar, highly processed food generally. And that chapter, by the way, was only speaking of things going on outside their home and separate from meals, not even including school meals, not even including desserts, you know, hidden sugar in our food supply. So I just thought that was worthy of pointing out. And also in each instance, I try to give the reader a little insight into what's going on. You know, why do we still have junk food fundraising in many districts, even after the Obama era reforms? You know, why are teachers feeling compelled sometimes to have candy rewards? What's going on with overcrowded classrooms or that kind of thing? So, you know, what's a parent to do? I certainly am not proposing that any particular food be taboo or that you keep your kids away from sugar altogether, anything like that. I really wrote this book first and foremost just to kind of validate parents, because I think today's parents really feel challenged. They're doing their best and they feel like their best efforts are being thwarted. And even in their own home, often things are going awry. But even if they're getting it right in their own house, however they define that, outside the house, their kids are bombarded. So I really wanted first to kind of validate them. You're not crazy. This is very difficult. Explain what's going on. Educate them. You know, really give them a big kind of bird's eye view of all of these issues. Not going deep in the weeds, just enough to explain it. And then, you know, this is the loftier goal of the book, and maybe it will fail, but it's to maybe awaken in parents a desire to shape this culture that's bombarding our children with unhealthy food. And that can be done in small ways or really large ways. So, and I don't mean to say small like this is easy, but it's a limited context. You could get some parents together, approach your soccer coach and say, listen, let's have a league where we just have water and not sports drinks. And by the way, here's all the data that I read in Kid Food, you know, about why sugary sports drinks are unnecessary. Kids are consuming more calories than they're burning off. You know, you could start there. And that alone is a really profound, important change in your child's and other children's daily food environment. But then, you know, we could go all the way to the other end of the spectrum, and perhaps parents reading, for example, my one chapter about school food might go, oh, wait a minute. You know, this is a thing we could vote on. This is a thing we could ask our politicians about in a town hall. We could submit this as a debate question. You know, that's not happening yet, I don't think. And my hope is that maybe we could get some political
activism.
Have
those conversations. My heart goes out to teachers. You mentioned that sometimes the teacher will give snacks to get control of the class, but there's always a price, because the kids might be happy to get their treats, but they get their sugar high and they're like crazy, and then they get their lows.
Right.
I had a friend, he's retired now, but he used to bring with him tons of fresh fruit cut up and reward kids, and some of these kids were so curious because there might have been fruits that they hadn't even seen before.
Right.
And he would always lecture them about the importance of fresh, clean water.
Right.
And hydration. And let me say that Gatorade is a disaster. They're artificial colors and sugars. And so many kids are challenged today with their attention deficit syndromes. And it's all primarily because what they're putting in their sensitive little bodies that shouldn't be put in their bodies.
Right. I don't know, you know, how sweeping a statement we can make about all attention deficit disorder,
sure.
but certainly diet is playing a role. It has to be, I think. I mean, you know, I cite experts in the book who, you know, it's really quite simple. If you start your day with a sugary, refined carb breakfast, which unfortunately is often the norm in school, you know, federally funded school breakfast, you're going to have a sugar crash. You're going to have an attention crash. And that, you know, that cannot be helping the situation.
Now, this is a big subject. And I just want to ask, I mean, you probably realize you couldn't talk about everything, but you don't talk about genetically modified foods and organic foods.
Right. That was a pretty conscious decision. Part of it is I just feel like that's a little bit out of my lane. You know, I like to stay in my lane. And it's not an area
I mean, you wrote about plenty of stuff.
Yeah,
in this
I did.
Book,
I feel
so
like
it's
I
not
covered,
like it's
right.
lacking of
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like I covered maybe more than I even should have attempted in 80,000 words. So, I try to stay in zones where I feel really well informed and confident of my knowledge or confident that I know who to talk to and the studies to read. When it comes to GMO, I'm kind of like an observer trying to figure things out like everyone else. So I stay away from that. And when it comes to organic, I mean, obviously, organic foods, I support organic eating and buying and growing. I try as much as I can to buy organic, but I'm very keenly aware that that can be well out of reach of so many families in this country. So I don't want to be in a position of saying, you know, you're not doing a good job of feeding your child well if you're not buying organic. I'd rather we just, you know, that can be a secondary goal, but let's first talk about just a diet that's richer in whole foods, however they're grown.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, we live in this highly processed world. Part of your title, and we're discovering, I mean, this is pretty recent news about not just genetically modified food, because some people might think there's not a problem with genetically modified food, but the fact that this glyphosate is used not only with genetically modified Roundup Ready crops, but it's also being used as a desiccant on many foods, and a lot of those foods are what go into children's foods, and we're finding that these glyphosate residues are really wreaking havoc. And so that's the importance of buying organic. And our school programs, hopefully one day, will be enlightened and they will serve the best food for children so that they can all have excellent education and be ready. I mean, there's a lot of room for improvement.
Well, so that's such a great point. So you say, you know, when our school food programs are enlightened. But the thing is, I think, you know, there are progressive school food directors out there that would be delighted to buy organic, would be delighted to avoid glyphosate in food. But we're not funding the program nearly to the degree that they could do that.
No,
we're
the government's not on board.
Exactly. We're not funding them even to the degree that they could just scratch cook conventionally grown fruits and vegetables. In many, many cases, they don't have the infrastructure. They don't have the labor. They don't have
I can dream.
Right. No, but that is, you know, that is a valid dream. I think that's really... Again, that's a goal. One goal of the book is that we, you know, for example, the public outcry about lunch shaming in the last 2-3 years has been so heartening to me, because that's been going on for decades, but now suddenly people are drawing the connection. Why do we have this 3-tiered system and we have these socioeconomic differences highlighted in the cafeteria? Why isn't lunch just part of the school day? Why isn't it just like going to gym class and getting your textbooks for free and getting the free bus ride to school? So I think it's just raising awareness, like, oh, why aren't we investing whatever it takes to feed this generation and all future generations well in school? And again, that's an issue we can
vote on.
Well,
we're talking about it, and
right.
That's positive,
exactly.
Because we weren't talking about it before, or
exactly.
At least not enough people were talking about
exactly.
Okay, now people may not know that Bettina Elias Siegel has been very effective with some change.org different issues, and one of them was involved with pink slime. I just want to talk about that, because that was amazing. I mean, it was amazing. Who remembers pink slime? Can you talk about pink slime and what you did?
Well, so I was... I grew concerned about this product, which the industry calls lean, finely textured beef. They don't like it when you call it pink slime. And in fact have sued people over the use of that name, so we should all be careful about it. But the way that name came to public attention is actually because Michael Moss, the author of Salt, Sugar, Fat, wrote this Pulitzer Prize winning series about the beef industry in 2009 in the New York Times, and through a Freedom of Information Act request, a FOIA request, got a hold of internal USDA documents, and one of the microbiologists was very, had written about lean, finely textured beef, and he used that term. So that's how that came to light. So at any rate, long story short, my concerns about this product in school food ground beef related to the revelations in Moss's story, and also the fact that it's not labeled. It's not required to be labeled. So it was in ground beef and can still be in ground beef, I believe, up to 15% without labeling. So that petition really caught fire. I would say less to do with me, because at that point I was a pretty unknown blogger, but more because the public generally was getting a lot of media coverage about it, and I think my petition became a vehicle for them to express their you know, interest in the issue. And so it, it really did catch fire. It got something like 250,000 signatures in 9 days. Ooh. I mean, it's interesting. I've done two other successful change.org petitions. The one I'm most proud of is actually one that was against McDonald's. You know, McDonald's had this quote-unquote nutrition education video they wanted to get into schools, and it was a science teacher who had eaten nothing but McDonald's for 6 months, three times a day. And that petition got like 90,000 signatures, but the press coverage was so gratifying. It was on the front page of the Washington Post, Today Show, and we actually got McDonald's to stop that program before it even started. So, you know, all the only reason why I share petition experience in the book, and really I only talk about the McDonald's one, is because I just want parents to know that is one avenue for advocacy. It's not useful in every case, but it is. It can be useful.
Yeah, people are like they're in petition overload sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. And at the time I did these petitions, I think they were far less common, so they may have gotten a little bit less effective. That's possible.
Our government, unfortunately, because of the USDA, because they're involved with promoting agriculture in this country, they will dump crap into the school food program.
Well, I'll say this. I mean, I think commodity food, which is the way agricultural, you know, excess winds up in on school lunch trays. From what I've read and, you know, talked to school nutrition directors, the quality of commodity food has greatly increased over the years. So, you know, it's I don't know if it's fair to say it's crap, but but nonetheless, I think just that tying of agricultural interests to a program that's meant to nourish school children is always going to create some potential problems, right?
Yes.
I mean, like, you know, I talk in the book about Domino's Smart Slice Pizza, which is a school food compliant pizza that is being promoted by the dairy industry and by an arm of USDA. So it's like, in other words, you have a governmental interest pushing pizza on kids at a time when we really don't need kids to be eating more pizza. They get plenty outside of school. So just that alignment of the USDA and the lunch program, I think, is something, I don't know if we'll ever be able to change that, but it's something that does lead to all kinds of strange and
we have to change it.
Desirable outcomes.
But
yeah.
More people are talking about it, so I like to think that change is possible.
Yes.
As we talk
about
it.
Same here.
Absolutely. Okay, we have like maybe 3 minutes left.
Okay.
Okay, so what else would... Oh, 5 minutes left. What else shall we cover in this book? What were some of your favorite discoveries?
Well, this was sort of fun and interesting, I think, and I opened the book with this. One of the most surprising things was I dove into the history of the children's menu, the restaurant children's menu, because I was really curious, like, when did they first show up? And more importantly, what was on them? Because today, as any parent knows, in almost every restaurant, whether it's a high-end restaurant, a chain restaurant, it's the same sorts of foods over and over, not very healthy, breaded, cheesy, fried. So I went into that research thinking, well, whenever these menus appeared, they probably had that era's equivalent of unhealthy but sort of fun food, because of course dining out was much less common back then. So it turns out they first showed up in the 20s for the most part. And what I discovered was they actually were created to give newly health-conscious moms back in the 1920s a feeling of comfort bringing their children to a restaurant, because children were supposed to have especially healthy, wholesome, bland, you know, foods. So in other words, moms didn't want to bring their kids out because they were afraid the food on the regular menu was not nutritious enough, and the children's menu gave them that reassurance. So it just was so indicative of a really powerful and troubling paradigm shift in how we think about feeding children today. We went from protecting them in restaurants to now parents can order the salad, but kids will never find a salad on their menu. And I thought that was an interesting way to open the book because it was so surprising.
Yeah, I also enjoyed reading your description of early school lunch foods, because those were the ones I remember.
Yes, yes. Right. I think we're probably of the same era. So.
Yeah. And we had the lunch ladies who were very intimidating. You know, they would bang on the tables and go, "The doors are open," and that meant we had to be quiet.
Oh, wow.
And we all were quite respectful of authority back then.
Right.
I know that it's changed quite a bit.
Right.
As long with the what's on the plate. I'm trying to think what we had back then, but the Wonder Bread, and my mom would pack lunches like they were so uninspired, bologna sandwiches and cheese sandwiches.
Right, right.
And oh, goodness, I used to eat all that stuff.
I have sort of fond memories of my school lunches. Really, I mean, I grew up in Tucson, Arizona, and I think, you know, reflective of the culture there, there was actually a lot of their attempt at kind of Mexican food, and it was pretty good. I mean, it really was, that's my memory anyway. Who knows? Mm-hmm. Who knows what I'd think of it if I saw it today?
I'm excited. I'm being in New York, and I wish it was consistent all around the country, but We have a few schools that offer vegetarian meals.
Yes, I've read that.
And we have Eric Adams, the Brooklyn Borough President, who may run for mayor. And he is so proactive about promoting plants, and he realizes the connection between performance and behavior,
right, right,
with plant food. So that's very exciting when you have politicians who are on your side. Absolutely. And are knowledgeable.
Absolutely. And you also have that program Wellness in the Schools, which has brought the alternative menu to many of your schools, which I think is fantastic. So mm-hmm. A lot of progressive stuff is happening here.
Yay, New York.
Yay, New York.
So how old are your children now?
Oh, they're pretty old. I have a 19-year-old and, you know, sophomore in college, and a 17-year-old, a senior in high school.
Mm-hmm. And what are they eating these days?
You know,
do you have any idea?
No, yeah, that's true. I probably don't know half of what they're eating. But no, it's all good. And I think that's part of why I wanted to share my early travails, particularly with my son, who I labeled a picky eater for all kinds of, I think, erroneous reasons that I share mm-hmm. in the book. I really wanted to open my own story up to people, because I would love parents to really take that long view. You know, you can compound picky eating and run into all kinds of trouble. But if you know... following the expert advice that I share in the book, not my advice, but from experts, I think kids really can progress and grow at the table, and that's totally been the case with my children.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up picky eaters. I forgot to mention that, because people need to know that it is not something that has to be with you for the rest of your life.
Right. We have this terrible tendency to see behaviors that, as I share in the book, are normal and expected developmental behaviors, and label children picky when we shouldn't.
That's the music that tells me we're at the end of the program. So Bettina Elias Siegel, author of Kid Food, The Challenge of Feeding Children in a Highly Processed World. Thanks for joining me on It's All About Food.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Everybody, it's Giving Tuesday. And I hope you're giving generously, and you can, to responsibilityandliving.com. That's my nonprofit. Meanwhile, have a delicious week. Bye-bye.